You're listening to a previously recorded Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we're going to listen back to some of the great live music that's been performed on the show so far this year. We're going to be talking with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson on this coming Thursday's show. That's when we would normally be highlighting the arts, so we're using today to bring you some of the best of what we've heard so far from our studio just in the first few months of 2019. But first, harmful algal blooms like red tide and blue-green algae produce toxins that can be harmful to humans. This is known. What's not known with certainty is exactly how harmful they can be and how far they're able to travel through the air. Back in November, a researcher here at Florida Gulf Coast University, Dr. Mike Parsons, started collecting data on where the airborne toxins produced by blue-green algae, or cyanobacteria, were showing up, and how deeply into the lungs those toxins could be inhaled. His initial findings didn't produce the clarity he sought, so he broadened his data collection effort. And earlier this month, Dr. Parsons released new information that shows the airborne toxins are present more than a mile inland from water bodies. And this raises as many questions as it answers when it comes to possible health effects for people who were exposed to the airborne toxins. Joining me now to get the latest and find out what's next for the research is Dr. Mike Parsons. He's professor of marine science here at FGCU and director of the university's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. Dr. Parsons, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And as always, we invite listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So let's start from the beginning, Dr. Parsons. Can you summarize for us when and how you started collecting information about airborne toxins produced by the blue-green algae?
Well, last year when these blue-green algal blooms were really having problems and causing difficulties, especially in Cape Coral canals, I would be talking to the media and get questions from concerned citizens. And this one woman had a question where she said that she was pregnant and lived on a yacht in the yacht basin. There was blue-green algae all around the yacht, and she was wondering if it was harming her unborn child. Mm. And so that kind of struck a nerve and really got me thinking, you know, what kind of exposure could she be underneath here? And so it was looking into the literature a little bit. I was trying to figure out, all right, if she's not swimming in the water, if she's not drinking the water, a lot of people were reporting on odor and difficulties with getting dizzy and things like that. So I said, well, what about being airborne? Is there issues with the toxin being airborne? So I looked in the literature and saw some data on it, but I didn't really see a lot of data that would be directly applicable to what we were seeing in Cape Coral.
Interesting. Well, I want to get to some of the known health impacts that scientists have alleged a little bit later. But first, tell me about some of the devices you've used to collect this information, both just trying to detect the presence of the airborne toxins, but then also realizing whether or not particle size would enable those toxins to be inhaled deeply into the body, because I think that was an aspect of the research
right.
too.
Yeah. So as I got more interested in the work and a little bit deeper in the research, I consulted with colleagues. And just through a good networking opportunity, I ended up with a researcher at Yale University, Jordan Pesha, who has these air samplers. They're called air impactors. And what the air impactors do is they basically filter out different size particles in a number of stages. So the largest particles will be filtered out in the top of the unit, and then a vacuum basically sucks everything through down to the bottom stage, which will have the very smallest particles. And so those smallest particles will actually get the deepest into your lungs, all the way down into your air sacs, which is where you have gas blood exchange. And so that would be the vector where if any toxins were present in the air and associated with these very small particles, that's how they would get into your bloodstream, and that would be the mode of exposure.
Gotcha. And again, you mentioned the concern about the from the pregnant woman, and I know that some research has linked exposure to some of these toxins to like neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, other serious conditions like some forms of cancer. But as you said, there's kind of a dearth in the scientific literature on this.
Yeah, so if you look at the two major toxin groups that we're concerned with would be microcystin, especially
yes.
microcystin LR, and then a compound known as BMAA. And so I received funding from NOAA to do this event response sampling. And one thing that was clear in talking with NOAA and talking with people from Center for Disease Control was we know a lot about microcystin in terms of its mode of action. It's a liver toxin. It's a hepatotoxin. And there are data showing that people can get liver damage from that. BMAA is a little trickier. So there's suggestions that it can be related to neurodegenerative diseases, ALS and so on. But it's a really hard compound to study. It's really hard to know what kind of environmental exposures people are being subjected to. And in both cases with microcystins and BMAA, we have no idea what the thresholds of concern would be in the air. So if we measure these toxins in the air, is that a lot? Is that a little? Should we be concerned or not? And there's no data on that to really answer that question.
Oh, right. So multiple challenges there. First, you're trying to just measure the presence of it in the air and then also figuring out what that could mean.
Exactly.
And your research findings from last fall were interesting because I know you found airborne cyanobacteria toxins in that area in Cape Coral by the canal where you would have expected to because of the blue-green algae presence there. But then in Bonita, where you were also testing air quality and there wasn't the presence of a blue-green algae at the time, you also found the toxins.
Yeah, that was a surprising result. And we not only detected toxins at our control site at the Vester Field Station, 30 miles away from the active blue-green algal bloom in Cape Coral, but they were at the same concentrations.
And same concentrations.
Yeah. And so, you know, that begs two questions. Number one, was there a cyanobacteria bloom that we didn't know about that was near the Vester Field Station? Or number two, could the toxins from Cape Coral be spreading around? We quickly rejected the second question because the winds were always blowing from the south during our deployment. So that meant that the Vester Field Station was actually upwind of Cape Coral. So if there were any toxins that were airborne, they would have been blowing to the north and away from Vester. So that must mean, or at least our hypothesis would be that there was another source of these toxins, or that it's just naturally ubiquitous. It's just in the air at background concentrations, because maybe the cyanobacteria don't have to bloom for these toxins to be in the air. They could just be present and it could put the toxins in the air.
And even I think adding on to the interest here is the latest information that you put out earlier this month testing air quality from a site in Buckingham. First of all, just give us an idea of where Buckingham is in relation to any water bodies of potential concern and what you found.
So Buckingham, there's the Buckingham FGCU campus.
Yes.
And so it's basically northeast of the main campus here, northeast of the airport, for example, Southwest Florida International. And we picked this site, number one, because of ease of access. But number two, it was at least a mile away from any detention pond or any standing body of water, at least 3 miles away from any stretch of the Coosahatchee River. So we felt comfortable we were far enough away from any water body that would have a significant influence on the toxin levels. And there were some things blooming in the Coosahatchee River. There was microcystin blooming in small patches, as it is now. But with these other retention ponds and things like that, they were far enough away that we assumed – we didn't test it, but we assumed that they were not a source of toxins. And so we put these – filtering units out, left them out for about a month, and we collected them and we measured toxins.
That's interesting because, I mean, even being that far away from a retention pond, I mean, just the size alone, you would think that's not as big of an issue as, say, you know, a large river system or the ocean.
I couldn't think of a way to get far enough away from any water body.
Right.
You know, because pretty soon
especially
you're going to end up over in the Everglades or Lake Okeechobee. And so – yeah, so it was kind of difficult to be away from any water source whatsoever.
Has this led you towards any further hypothesis or just the realization that much more research needs to be done?
I think yes to both of those. So in terms of other hypotheses, I think it's still a valid hypothesis that these toxins are naturally occurring in background levels. The levels that we measured were around 5 times lower than what we measured in the fall. So okay. What that tells us is the toxins can be lower than we measured them in the fall. We don't know if they can be higher. So this year we'll be looking at collecting samples, putting the air samplers out before a cyanobacteria bloom happens. If it does, we'll be prepared. We all hope it does not, but we need to prepare for it just in case and really get a sense of how high or how low these toxin concentrations can get in the air. And then the second part is what do these toxin concentrations represent in terms of a risk to human health? And so that's a whole other ball of wax, really. And I'm an oceanographer, so I don't study human health. So that's going to really involve collaborations with other researchers.
Has the Department of Health had anything to say about any of this so far?
They're very interested. And most of the work that they do is with state mandates, and they have their rules and regulations and their marching orders. So this is a little bit outside of their purview in terms of work. And they tend to rely on university research to kind of push the envelopes in knowledge. And so they're very supportive, and they realize that this is something that needs to be looked at and needs to be done. And so, you know, we're looking forward to continuing the work and communicating with Department of Health and other interested parties.
Gotcha. And as you had previously stated, you know, looking at these health impacts is you know, maybe a bit outside your scope of practice. But there are other research efforts that have been looking for the presence of these toxins in human bodies, like at Florida Atlantic University. So I understand that's a potential collaboration you're looking into for the future.
Yeah, I've been in contact with Adam Schaefer over at Harbor Branch, and we've talked about collaborating. I've talked with some medical doctors and other researchers who study aerosols, again, Center for Disease Control as well. And we need to formulate a game plan on what the next step is. Do we need to collect more preliminary data? But ultimately, this is going to result in a large National Institutes of Health grant proposal to study this. And it's going to have epidemiology components. It's going to have, of course, the field and ecological components. But it's going to be a very large multidisciplinary study.
All right. Well, you know, we very much look forward to hearing more from you in the future as this continues to develop. And if you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with FGCU Professor of Marine Sciences, Dr. Mike Parsons, discussing his new research findings into how far airborne toxins produced by blue-green algae can travel from the water. We're now going to pivot to a related issue, and that's Florida Gulf Coast University's new water school. Announced late last week, the water school will bring experts at the university from across disciplines together to tackle the many and varied water-related issues we face here in Southwest Florida. We're also joined in studio by Dr. Greg Tolley. He's professor of marine science here at FGCU and chair of the Department of Marine and Ecological Sciences. Dr. Tolley, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Also, just want to remind folks they can add their voice to the discussion as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So let's just start off. Give me a primer for this new water school.
Well, we're really excited about it. We had a very good day on the water on Friday announcing the water school. The water school builds on the expertise and the strengths we have in the area. People like Mike, Dr. Parsons here, and other good faculty have been doing work on water for the last 20-some years now. So we have a strong track record of focusing on issues that are of importance to Southwest Floridians. As Mike mentioned, we're also, as part of the Water School, we're going to be collaborating with other partners, other experts in the region. We've already done that to a large extent, but there are emerging issues such as the harmful algal blooms, specifically the blue greens, that have a lot of unanswered questions that we need to partner with people as well. The Water School is also hiring a new faculty, and I'm happy to say that one of those new faculty members, the search is going on right now, will be for a waterborne illness and biotoxins person specifically.
Right.
So that hire will substantially augment Mike's research and some of the questions that we can answer. We're also looking at somebody, or we're going to be hiring somebody to answer questions about climate adaptation and coastal resilience. We've already hired a hydrologist. And then we'll also be looking to hire somebody who's got expertise in ecological economics as well, not only to tell us what the costs of some of these impacts are and what the costs of some of the improvements would take or some of the mitigation, but also to start talking about how to bring environmental capital into the economic equation in Southwest Florida. And, of course, the number one thing we're interested in, we think this is a great opportunity for our students to learn important parts, important areas of the region, but also to be able to apply those as they move forward in their careers, because we think water is going to be a big career issue moving forward into the foreseeable future.
So is this going to culminate in some kind of water-specific degree program eventually?
We haven't decided on something like that now. We're always looking for degree programs that are of use to our students and who are a benefit to the region. So that's something we can explore. But right now we have three existing undergraduate programs from marine science and environmental studies and to our new program in environmental geology. And we have two graduate programs, two master's programs, one in environmental studies and the other in environmental science. And so those students will be the ones that will directly benefit. And we've already got a call. I got a call or an email the other day from a young man in New Jersey who already wants to come and take classes at the water school. So word's getting out.
Excellent, excellent. And speaking of that, I saw a billboard on it for on McGregor Boulevard, as you're heading towards the beaches. So it looks like you're already well on your way to getting the message out.
Well, the university's done an outstanding job of supporting us in this effort and making sure that we have a make a splash in the area in the school. And some of the hard work will really start now, including figuring out what the exact structure of the school will be, what the reporting structure will be. And so we'll be working on that in the coming months to actually help make this thing make it real.
And is there a concept you have in mind for where this would primarily be housed? By that I mean, would you be primarily located at the Vester Field Station or maybe a combination of different hubs, both on the main campus and at other satellite campus areas around Southwest Florida?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes to all of those. Vester is a big part of who we are, certainly, but we also have the Everglades Wetland Research Park down at the Naples Botanical Garden, our Kapnick Center down there. We're going to be collaborating with the administration and with our College of Engineering to temporarily house some staff at the Emergent Technologies Institute, just a few miles north of here, as you know. And then, of course, the big thing on the horizon is what we call Academic Building 9. Academic Building 9, we have about $35 million in funding allocated by the legislature so far. We need about another $21 million to break ground on that and plan and make that thing happen. That will be the largest building on campus, and it's primarily focused on providing research and teaching classrooms to augment our real space needs here. We're cramped. Mike can tell you in his lab, for example, he's got a lot of people looking over his shoulder, a lot of students from different faculty members working together. So this new academic building will be a huge advantage, and it will house the Water Institute. I'm sorry, the Water School.
Got you. And has the Water School something that's been sort of conceptually on your plate for a while now? I mean, because as you were saying before, it seems like FGCU, just based on where we're located and based on the resources we already have and the research already being done, it's such a perfect fit. What finally, I guess, was the catalyst for solidifying this and giving it a name?
Well, you're right. It's been building for a while. I think the final catalyst was we had to make a decision sometime when to make it happen and keep the momentum going. But we built the Coastal Watershed Institute a number of years ago. Mike is now chairing that, and Darren Rumbold will soon take over that position. And the Coastal Watershed Institute was kind of the water-related research arm of our department. This is kind of, in some ways, Coastal Watershed Institute 2.0. We're expanding our collaborations. We're bringing in not only collaborators from within the university, but also partners outside as well. So I think that's going to be the next big step for us, just building on the good work we've already done. But it's nice to see the university putting additional resources towards expanding those capabilities and the capacity to do research.
And you mentioned some of the additional staff the university has already hired or is going to be hiring as it relates to the Water School. And I know one of those is going to be an environmental economist. That I thought was a pretty interesting aspect. Can you speak more to that?
Well, sure. Water drives our economy down here. It drives our business. It drives our recreational choices. It impacts our economic equation down here in Southwest Florida. And when we see something happen like we did the last year and a half, we had Hurricane Irma. We then had red tide, and then blue-green algaes as well, and that had tremendous impacts on the local economy. People not choosing to go to the beach, people not choosing to eat at seafood restaurants, businesses essentially crawling at zero, and of course, tourists not coming to Southwest Florida. There's a huge tax base that's associated with that as well. So we want to know the economic impacts of these things. I think once we know the economic impacts of these kinds of events, it'll help us to understand how much resources is reasonable to apply towards mitigating them. So that's a big, important part of the question. But we also think an ecological or environmental or ecological economist can also help us in terms of looking at coastal resilience. You know, sea levels are rising here. Everybody in Miami is convinced of that now. They've had to spend billions of dollars to raise their road levels and kind of put pumps in to floodproof the city. We're not at that that level of risk as soon as Miami is, but it's coming. And so we need to learn how to build differently, to build smart, and to think about a future where sea level is going to be rising here in Southwest Florida.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that. I remember, you know, even relatively recently seeing, you know, hoteliers that were, you know, suffering from high vacancy rates actually posting like real-time videos, because the perception was definitely out that tourists didn't want to come here. But then once conditions improved, that negative perception continued to pervade. So definitely interesting economic standpoint.
Well, there. And of course, that's one of the issues with global warming and climate change generally. It kind of creeps up on us slowly. Fast in terms of a scientific period of time, but socially slowly, whereas things like the blue-green algae and the red tide bloom this last year, we're hoping that'll be a transformative event, that it will stick in people's minds. And even if the blooms don't come back next year, people will still keep that on their radar and they'll urge their politicians and local civic leaders to do the same.
Gotcha. And relatedly, I know FGCU is seeking some $9 million from the state to study red tide. I know the Florida House and Senate released their own competing budget plans late last week. Both include funding for water quality improvement research. The House plan actually has about $18 million less than the $625 million sought by Governor DeSantis. The Senate plan is significantly higher. But at this point, since the legislative session is ongoing, are we just kind of in a wait-and-see mode when it comes to whether or not we'll get that allocation?
Well, I wouldn't say we're in a wait-and-see mode. We're making our case, certainly, for that. And we're also – this would be if we get a portion or all of that funding, it would not only support programs here, but we would have to collaborate with other important institutes and organizations in the field who've got a head start on us in this area.
Gotcha. Well, we do have just a couple more minutes, so I wanted to give each of you an opportunity to maybe give us some final thoughts, Dr. Parsons, either on your research or Dr. Tolley on this larger water school initiative.
Well, I think it's important for people to realize that, as Greg mentioned, we've been doing water-related research for, you know, up to 20 years or so. And so you know, we have experience doing this kind of work. And with the launch of the water school, that basically just culminates all of this knowledge and expertise that we have, and, you know, puts it under one umbrella, under one entity that it'll be, you know, better to communicate with the public about who we are and what we do. And also, you know, a lot of these different issues that have been coming up, we've been studying to varying degrees. And so we are aware of our local water issues and the impacts it has on the environment. And increasingly the impacts that it has on the public and local businesses. And those are things that we want to strive for. As a regional university, you know, we really take it seriously that our focus should be looking on local and regional issues and being a source for our local people and you know, other stakeholders and tourists in the area.
Dr. Tolley, final thoughts?
Yeah, final thoughts. Well, water shapes the way we think, the way we communicate, the way we express ourselves, the way we feel. So we feel that it's now time to have a more interdisciplinary approach to cast our net more broadly as we seek collaborations, whether it's psychology or business or hydrology, sociology. All those fields, I think, can be very, very important. And I think it's important. I tell my faculty, you know, our number one job is our students, but our number two commitment is to our communities. And we think this is an institute, this new water school that's going to focus specifically on areas of concern for all Southwest Floridians. So the water school is actually going to focus on those issues specifically and make its curriculum decisions and its hiring decisions based on those issues.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Mike Parsons, professor of marine science and director of the Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. Dr. Parsons, thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Also, thanks so much to Dr. Greg Tolley. He's professor of marine science and chair of the Department of Marine and Ecological Sciences here at FGCU. Dr. Tolley, thanks so much for speaking with us as well. We look forward to having you both back on the program in the future to explore these expanding opportunities and research initiatives.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, we're going to listen back to some of the great live music we've heard on the show so far this year. I'm John Davis. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.